You never hear that expression, tamp up.
Tamp on.
Okay.
There's tamp down, tamp on.
These intros are getting increasingly tamp, inappropriate.
Tamp. By the way, tamp on is not inappropriate.
Yeah.
That's sexist. You guys are uncomfortable with...
Don't you guys that. Nate, it's tamp down, tamp on.
Tamp on, tamp on, tamp on, tamp on, tamp on.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk. Before we begin, for the sake of full transparency, we are recording this intro for a second time. We actually initially recorded a segment about the scandal surrounding Governor of Virginia Ralph Northam and his lieutenant governor as well, Fairfax. And we kind of decided, just because news was moving so quickly while we were recording, that anything we might say right now might not necessarily make sense by the time this goes to air. So we are actually going to have a separate conversation, a separate podcast about those topics once we have more solid ground to record on. But for today, we have plenty of other things to talk about, and of course, we will follow up and talk about the situation in Virginia. So, the topics for today: the pool of Democratic candidates running for president in 2020 expanded again. Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, announced last Friday that he's running. And also, in light of all the new proposals to tax millionaires and billionaires, we are going to talk about the politics of taxing the rich. So here with me to do that, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Good. I'm so relieved we don't have to give our hot takes on the switch moving literally too fast for us to cover.
Although
too hot to handle.
We have like 15 minutes of hot takes on that became irrelevant.
That will
20
never
minutes
see the light of day.
It'll go in the 538 presidential library.
Along with the comment that Micah made last week that we are not airing. We only aired the response from the crew. Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire, how's it going?
It's going very well.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey there, Micah. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Listeners, Galen, Nate, and Claire admitted before we started recording today that my comment was not vulgar and
that
the fault lies with them for having filthy and dirty minds.
That is false.
And would you want any other kind of mind interpreting the news for you? Razor sharp, open to all possibilities.
And with those razor sharp, open to all possibilities, dirty minds, let's move on to the news at hand, beginning with the next installment of Theory of the Case. So cue the music.
Senator Cory Booker, come on down.
Yes, that is right. Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, is running for president. He's 49. He's the former mayor of Newark. And if he were to win, he would be the third unmarried man ever elected president and the first in over 120 years. Shout out to Grover Cleveland, who was elected while he was single but got married in office.
Yeah, he did.
Grover, who was the other one?
James Buchanan, who was never married. I think even Nate Silver, when I was looking up single presidents, somebody had quoted you as saying that James Buchanan was the worst president ever.
Didn't he, like,
I don't
really...
think that's my view. He
was accelerated
allegedly the gayest president ever.
Yeah, I've heard that.
More importantly, though, what is Cory Booker's policy and ideological background? Claire, how does he fit into the party?
Cory Booker is an interesting ideological Democrat in some ways, because in the current Democratic Party, I think he falls into the lane of one of those people who's trying to be really outwardly progressive. So he was one of the co-sponsors of Sanders' Medicare for All bill in 2017. He is this universal jobs guarantee. He's, you know, for decriminalization of marijuana. He has a lot of sort of criminal justice forward proposals. But on the other hand, Booker has a history as frankly, a politician in the tri-state area of being cozy with moneyed interests. So there's some influence of big pharma in New Jersey and New Jersey politics. He's also a fan of charter schools. So in general, Booker has gotten a rap from the left as being a kind of Wall Street big money guy, masquerading as everyone has described his campaigns, including the current one for president, as like these love forward politics. He's the guy who's like always going to have a smile on his face. He's that sort of politician in some ways, minus his grandstanding in the Kavanaugh hearings, which were distinctly unsmiley. So Booker's an interesting politician because I think his public persona is progressive liberal, but there's some history there that is less so.
The Occam's razor interpretation of Booker's record is not that he's a secret centrist masquerading as a liberal. It's that he's a liberal representing New Jersey. And New Jersey has big concentrations of yeah. Wall Street workers and pharmaceutical workers.
New York and New Jersey politicians are always going to, I think, are always going to, well, minus someone like, say, Ocasio-Cortez, who's very...
But she's a representative in one district, right?
Yeah. There's massive wealth and corporate power concentrated in this part of the East Coast.
It's a case where the national nature of our politics now is out of sync with, to some extent, the still kind of constituency-based nature of, you know, congressional representation, where Booker has taken positions on issues regarding Wall Street and, like, the importation of drugs from Canada to the benefit of powerful interests in his constituency. But, like, it's not that different. You know, we should talk a little bit about the comparison to Obama, which a lot of people have made and which there's merit to. You know, Obama worked with these groups, too. In some ways, it's like an interesting reflection of how the party's changed since Obama. Nobody batted an eye, really, at Obama working with, you know, the insurance industry on Obamacare. I mean, people batted an eye, but it wasn't like...
Yeah.
Know.
Okay, so what is the case, let's start with you, Nate, for why Cory Booker will win the Democratic nomination?
Well, I'm not sure that I think he will.
I know, but this is a thought exercise. Come on, Nate. Play along.
So the case is, number one, according to our so-called five corners metric, where you look at who can you appeal to different constituencies within the party, he's someone who, sort of like a Kamala Harris, might be able to unite several different groups, perhaps apart from the left. Although, again, if you look at his issue voting in Congress, then apart from Wall Street, he is, like, pretty darn progressive. I think you would say he's progressive or liberal or not on the left. You might have an in with black voters if you're Cory Booker, obviously. You're also representing a diverse state in Congress, or perhaps other types of non-white voters. You know, the party establishment might see him as someone who's been, like, a good, loyal Democrat and fought the good fight. And they might say, well, he seems pretty electable. He's a, you know, he's a good-looking guy and, like, you know, he's
good to play, speaker.
Good speaker. He used to play football and, like, doesn't come across as terribly radical.
Americans
has a good story.
Love football.
Americans love football. Although maybe less after that Super Bowl last night. Let's be honest.
My thoughts about that.
Look, on paper, he has a lot of positives and this one big negative, which is his Wall Street ties. So on paper, he looks kind of good. The question is, like, he does not seem to be a lot of people's first choice. There was a Monmouth poll out today. And again, take with fairly large grains of, like, salt.
Like Malden flakes.
Just they're because,
like,
of how early it is.
Salt. Like, yeah, take that with grain of salt, right? But he's, like, you know, only like at 4%, and that's pre-announcement. Maybe he'll get a boost. We'll see. I think there's, like, a little mini competition between him and Gillibrand. Gillibrand, who, by the way, was at 1% in that poll. They're kind of competing for the same donor base potentially. But yeah, and his thing's going to be like, I'm going to be like someone everyone can live with. You'll overcome your Wall Street objections and or you'll have those, but that's okay. And I'm going to raise a lot of money potentially from New York and New Jersey and Connecticut anyway, especially if Gillibrand doesn't. You're now a two-term senator from New Jersey, which is a pretty big, pretty blue state. So he's got, like, a very traditional path to the presidency in some ways.
Perry made an interesting point in his theory of the case piece, which was that the black vote is a big part of the Democratic primary constituency, and this is the first election where they have more than one, like,
right,
plausible candidate who could be a top-tier candidate. And Perry pointed out that while Harris and Booker, as two black candidates in the race, are they're competing for the black vote in some level, that, you know, maybe Booker faces a challenge because that black electorate is largely made up of women, or primarily made up of women, and maybe black women will be more inclined to want to see a historic victory for a black woman in Harris.
It's something like 60% of the black vote is women.
Is women, yeah. And so I do think it, in some ways, again, it's always a good reminder that these theories of the case that we lay out when people jump in are what we know about them now. They're theories.
Theories, yeah.
And I think with, you know, with Booker and Harris, Booker has been, like, a very high-profile retail politician for, like, close to 20 years. He was the Twitter mayor. His rollout video was very sort of polished in a certain way. He does kind of speak that like peace, love, and understanding kind of language. And Harris has only been a senator for 2 years. I'm still really curious to see what she's like just on the stump. And I do think that that could make a lot of difference in like where voters decide to go within the black vote, like who they see as a more viable candidate.
I am totally fascinated by, we are sort of in uncharted territory here with multiple non-white candidates in viable, serious, really strong candidates in the field. So maybe black voters are either like, well, we want a black woman this time, or two, maybe as Perry wrote, they don't feel the need to sort of make history as we saw somewhat in 2008. But the other interesting point Perry made, which I think could be a larger problem for Booker, is that, as Claire said, he has a really optimistic, can-do, let's all get along persona and message, and that might ring dissonant in 2020 when Democrats are gearing up to run against Trump.
Do we have any data on that? Do voters want an optimistic message? Have they told us?
I wrote a little bit about this back in the fall, and this is about how Americans feel about compromise on policy issues, and Democrats in particular, so I'm just going to quote here. This is citing Pew data. In 2018, 53% of Americans preferred politicians who stuck to their, you know, their policy guns, which was a big change from 2017 when only 39% said they liked people who stuck to their guns and didn't want to compromise. You know, and Republicans have long had an aversion to this kind of political compromise, but 2018 was a transition point for Democrats, according to this Pew data. In 2017, 69% of Democrats said they liked politicians who compromised, but in 2018, only 46% of Democrats said the same thing. So, what it's worth, Democrats are a little bit more into holding the line.
Our way or the highway. And right. I think there is danger for Booker in those numbers. Now, having a positive message is not quite the same thing as being pro-compromise or having a message that we need to take half a loaf here. You know, Booker might be able to position himself as, to use a cliche, the happy warrior who is going to fight for progressive priorities, but do it in an upbeat, you know, optimistic way. So it's not, I'm not saying, I don't think anyone's saying that you can't run an upbeat campaign, but I do think he'll have to do some type of positioning there to make clear to voters, particularly because he has this existing issue with the left of the party. He'll have to do some type of messaging to say, hey, I'm actually going to fight for these issues.
Part of what we're trying to gauge, though, is a certain attribute or skill overpriced or underpriced in the market for Democratic candidates that we can all agree that, yeah, probably Democrats are in a more confrontational mood. They also think they can beat Trump, and so therefore they don't think they have to necessarily come across as more collegial and bipartisan, and they want revenge for Brett Kavanaugh and all these things that the GOP has done. At the same time, like, if every Democratic candidate behaves that way, then there is space for someone to go on an opposite platform and differentiate. And so it's kind of like, yeah, what if 60% of the market is for confrontation and 40% is for collegiality, but you have, you know, one collegial candidate and six combative candidates, then you might rather be the collegial one, which is why I think whether Beto O'Rourke runs or not, which I think now is a more question than it might have seemed a month or two ago, I think there is a potential overlap there for that style of politics and would help Booker if Beto were not to run. And maybe Biden, I don't know where Biden falls in that spectrum, but I do think that like Booker is competing head-to-head with a lot of people in the different realms of his candidacy. So if black voters are looking for a black candidate, he's competing with Kamala Harris.
At least, and there may be others as well.
If people want like a sunny, optimistic can-do candidate, then Beto O'Rourke if he runs. You know, I do think, again, like there is a little bit of regionalism, and so both being able to raise money and maybe overperform in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, which is actually quite a few delegates, he's competing with Gillibrand. So how many of those three confrontations is he favored in? Because you have to kind of win all these head-to-head battles to eventually become nominated. I mean, I do think he probably had a better rollout. It seemed like a more positive reaction than Gillibrand. You know, Beto has not run yet. I don't know. I would love to see, does he eat up any of Kamala Harris's vote when we have these, yes, very preliminary, but nonetheless somewhat interesting polls that come out post-announcement?
Okay, well, it sounds like we've discussed both the case for how he could win and plenty of reasons he also could lose. So let's move on to a policy topic. We won't necessarily get into the nitty-gritty of the policy, but the politics of it. And that policy is Democrats' interest in taxing the super rich. But before we get to that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers. By now, most of us have started racking our brains about what Valentine's gift is truly going to make the day special. With 1-800-Flowers.com, it's really not that complicated. Roses from 1-800-Flowers are a no-brainer. Right now, when you order early, 1-800-Flowers has amazing deals on vibrant and romantic Valentine's rose bouquets, arrangements, and more, starting at just $29.99. Roses from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak and shipped overnight to ensure freshness and amazement. Bouquet prices are going up soon, so take advantage today. Pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. When it comes to Valentine's, don't settle for anything less than the Rose Authority. 1-800-Flowers.com. To order Valentine's bouquets and arrangements and more starting at $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code POLITICS. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com, code POLITICS. Micah, have you picked out my bouquet for
I was about to say, I haven't got my flowers from you yet, so.
I mean, we have 10 more days. It's only the 4th.
Well, I like roses. I like tulips, actually.
I think roses are lovely, but I would say that if you're going for a rose, the garden rose is preferable to the sort of tightly wound classic florist rose on Valentine's Day.
Just a garden variety rose?
Like a tea rose. You know, like they're more... Their blossoms unfurl a little more.
No one got that joke.
Papery. What did you say?
I said just a garden variety rose.
That's good, Micah. Anyway, tulips are a good flower.
All right. And again, if you're looking for something a little bit extra for Valentine's Day, we have our next sponsor for you. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper Mattress. Want to upgrade your sleep game? Look no further than Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products and not so outrageous prices. From mattresses and pillows to sheets and duvets, transform the way you sleep. This mattress is a game changer. Experience Casper for yourself and get the sleep you deserve. The Casper mattress combines 4 layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under the shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, breathable foams are designed to keep you cool at night. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. You'll even get a risk-free trial on all mattresses. And with Casper's President's Day sale happening now, it's the perfect time to upgrade your mattress. What are you waiting for? Upgrade your sleep game right now by going to Casper.com. You'll get 10% off any purchase with a mattress today. That's Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Additional fees may apply to Hawaii and Alaska.
The official 538 sponsored Valentine's Day then is get your significant other a Casper mattress. Spread 1-800-Flowers petals all over it.
Ooh, such a romantic.
Do we have a candle?
Sprinkle it with diamonds.
Do we have a candle sponsor? We need a Yankee
get in touch.
Candle.
Drip hot wax all over them.
I was just going to say, put candles by the bed, Claire. Jeez.
Okay, guys. The idea of imposing new taxes on the super rich has been getting a lot of play in the Democratic Party lately. Elizabeth Warren is proposing a new wealth tax. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez floated a new income tax. And last week, Bernie Sanders introduced a new estate tax. In general, these policies would be focused on people with tens of millions or even billions of dollars. And it seems to be a significant theme in the Democratic Party right now. So it's worth asking why and how realistic politically these policies are. So, Nate, let's start with you. Why are some Democrats making big pushes to tax the rich?
Because people on the left believe there should be a more equal distribution of income and wealth, and because it's a popular idea, especially in the Democratic primary and maybe with the general electorate. It's pretty one-on-one, Galen. It's an easy question.
I mean, got to get that out of the way. Is it a strategic argument? Or is this a top priority for Democrats if they take the White House, if they have the opportunity to, they will maybe even begin their policy agenda by levying significant tax increases on the super wealthy?
I think it's a policy priority for Democrats. I think we're living in the 10-year later reality of the financial crash. It's the maturation of the American public's view on the financial system and the wealthy. And I think it's across the board. Trump was... ironically, saying some of this stuff during the campaign. it is, I do think, some kind of fundamental reshaping of the way Americans think about the financial system.
Yeah, and has happened in lockstep almost with increasing inequality. So it's sort of easy to explain based on fundamentals. But I will say, I think it's a genuine felt belief among these politicians. It's also a electoral strategy, yeah, and probably a successful one, 100% in the Democratic primary. But as Nate said, it also, versions of this question pull pretty well with the general electorate.
Trumpism is also a step back or a pivot, I hate using the term pivot, from Reaganism. And Reaganism kind of very much was a reaction to the perceived like tax and spendness of Democrats in the 1970s and the sluggish economy in the 1970s. And, you know, Reagan was kind of very good at a lot of messages that kind of worked at that time, where you kind of tie lower taxes for the rich and other people. And by the way, sometimes in the GOP messaging of like the past few years, the other people get kind of forgotten about, where there wasn't that much for the middle class in this GOP tax bill, for example. Between the GOP losing just the kind of memory of Reaganism and what that stood for, and also the fact that you have more wealth inequality and income inequality, the fact that I think the Paul Ryan version of this has not been very much about the middle class, the fact that smaller government is a message that has been complicated. But it is like the page has been turned, number one. And number two, there aren't the same gatekeepers, where if you have like a lot of really rich, influential people in politics, then they can be as liberal or as conservative as they want, kind of as long as you don't go after their sources of power and wealth. And so an environment where the gatekeepers are discredited for whatever reason, and the gatekeepers include the media, by the way, then there's the fact that, oh my gosh, actually you pull this issue and some of these ideas are actually quite popular. I think Elizabeth Warren's polls actually better than the Ocasio-Cortez proposal, although the Warren way is in some ways more quote-unquote radical because you're taking money that people have already banked, so to speak. I think for a long time, Democrats were afraid to propose ideas like this.
They're not afraid anymore.
Not afraid anymore.
Let's get a little bit more into the numbers behind this. We say that it's popular amongst Americans. What's popular and how popular?
Well, that's a long question to answer. There are a bunch of different proposals floating around, and they poll differently, and they poll differently depending on how you word it. But Gallup for a long time has asked people whether they think different groups, income groups, pay their fair share or too much or too little. And you can see that the share of people who say upper income people pay too little is at like 62%, a clear majority. Only about 10% say upper income people pay too much. Morning Consult, working with Politico, found that 3 in 4 people, or 76% of registered voters, believe the wealthiest Americans should pay more in taxes. A Fox News poll found 70% think people earning over $10 million should pay more, including a majority of Republicans. It varies depending on the proposal and the wording, but you know, anywhere from like a small majority to an overwhelming majority generally favor more taxes on the rich.
One thing I think has been interesting to watch in the past week, frankly, since like some of this, the AOC comments about billionaires, and since these couple of proposals from progressive senators have come out about taxing the rich, is that Schultz has called these plans un-American. In various ways, he has used the term un-American. And Bloomberg, who I think is our other high-profile centrist, has said that they would plunge America into something like the socialism in Venezuela. And then as the socialism in Venezuela has become this thing that is held over, it's like this new rhetorical thing on the center to right, where people say, don't follow these policies, we're going to end up like Venezuela, in part because Venezuela is going through a political crisis right now. But it's interesting to watch the polling on this in the American public, and then to watch the anti-progressive policy rhetoric that goes to the extreme of this will make us Venezuela.
Well, it's a little out of date, right?
Because that's what it feels like.
Yeah, I don't think that has the...
I mean, the Schultz candidacy, not to talk about
it all again, comes back to Schultz.
but Schultz, and in some ways Bloomberg, when Bloomberg first started talking about running, and you know, he might still, there was an initial blush of reaction that was, this is so out of date. This is so like the centrism of the Bill Clinton era Democratic Party responding to Reaganism, right? And I think it's been interesting to watch responses to someone like Bloomberg, who I think is a general election candidate. I don't know. You know, like that might have some appeal. But to the Democratic primary electorate, it feels out of touch.
Yeah.
Maybe for the Democratic primary electorate. But to be fair, we've talked about Democratic views of socialism. When you ask Republicans or Republican leaners, there's only 16% of those respondents say that they have a positive view of socialism. 71% say they have a positive view of capitalism. So these policies, when talked about nationally through the lens of capitalism versus socialism, still can spook people.
And the one thing I will say, that's totally a fair point. I think Bernie Sanders and the personage of Bernie Sanders actually did quite a lot to normalize these kinds of policies because people saw Bernie as like just a grump, you know, like
a curmudgeon.
I think because younger people of color are now becoming more high profile faces of this progressivism in America, I do think you might see stronger backlash perhaps from people on the right because it's a different face for the socialism than what Bernie Sanders presented.
Yeah. And to be clear, there probably will be a backlash. These issues pull really well with Democrats and they pull pretty well overall. But some of the more aggressive policies put forward, I'm sure will pull poorly among Republicans. Like, I actually think this is an example. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has a proposal. Sanders has a proposal. Warren has a proposal. Even Cory Booker has, like, you know, the
baby bonds.
The baby bonds. Like, all, I think this is a case where the specifics might matter, where something like a 1% levy on households with a net worth of more than $1 billion, I think that's in the Warren plan, might go over a little differently than, you know, the Sanders wants to expand the federal estate tax on the wealthiest 0.2% of Americans. Anyway, you know, the specifics could end up mattering because I do think there is still this sort of aversion to redistribution, maybe is a way to put it.
Yeah. And in fact, when you include words like redistribution in the polling, you get a different response. There's a Washington Post article that kind of explains that when you cue people that the policies that you're asking them about are something that, you know, Democrats are for and Republicans have been against and have to do with socialism versus capitalism, the responses change. But anyway, we talked about how there's significant support for these policies amongst the American public. What are the roadblocks to imposing these kinds of taxes?
Wealthy people.
Well, for one thing, it's the roadblock to any significant Democratic policy, which is that you're going to have a majority, not just to the House, which is pretty easy. They have a majority of the House now, and the presidency, which we can discuss later, right? But the Senate is really tricky, especially if it is deemed that you have to break the Senate filibuster, because they're not going to, in any world, have 60 votes for this stuff, right? They might have 50, counting the vice president's tiebreaker and Joe Manchin, or 51 or 52, and that's pretty difficult in the short run. In the long run, there might be so much momentum for more leftist economic ideas that, like, what the new normal is in 10 or 20 years is quite different. So, yeah, barrier number one is, like, you have to have a lot of power in the Senate, and the Senate makes it very hard for Democrats to get a lot of power, given that their strength is in high population urban states. Number two, I am not an expert on this. I think there is some question about the constitutionality of a wealth tax, and I will say nothing more about it than that. Like, when I see people debating this, it seems like a real debate and not a fake debate. And so that actually seems like, in some ways, to be the more popular idea. I think, like, although they both poll well, I think, like, saying 2% is an easier sell than 70%. And if Democrats were, like, trying to push the Overton window on things, with it, let's just start out with, like, a
70% marginal tax rate. Everybody leaves out the marginal.
People do leave out the marginal, yeah. But that also still polls fairly well if you set the threshold high enough at 10 million or whatever. But no, it's just like accumulating enough power, whereas, like, I think Democrats do have to think of this as like a long game.
They would need a veto-proof majority in the Senate to overturn a veto from President Schultz. So, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen in the
short term. No, if Schultz is veto, then, so
how many do they need? More than 60?
So we got 2 more years of Trump, and then the 8 years Schultz obviously be reelected, right? So this is at least 10 years off. No, but I think Democrats need to see this as, like, comparable to, like, the movement conservatism in kind of the Reagan days, and be willing to play this out.
Yeah,
8, 10, 12, 15 years, 20 years, and gain ownership over this issue and change overused term, Overton window, and like the paradigms people use to say what is in the center and what isn't, right? And maybe 70% is deemed to be a bridge too far, but maybe it's 50% on incomes over 20 million or something, right? Because right now, after whatever it is, after 380,000 or something, there's no further graduation in marginal tax rates, which kind of seems like a little weird. And so I think there are lots of opportunities for Democrats to like start winning the long-term messaging war, you know, but for almost any Democratic proposal, and they have very ambitious plans, you know, how do you get there in 2020? That's kind of a big problem.
Do we expect, Claire, that every Democratic candidate running for president is going to have to back some kind of proposal that increases taxes on the rich?
Like if Michael Bloomberg runs as a Democrat, no, right?
Or maybe even more so because he's Bloomberg.
Yeah, that he'll have to adopt something.
Yeah.
I think most mainstream Democratic candidates will adopt that. Yeah, I do.
Does that put them at risk at all in the general, or that's not really a
concern? I don't think so, based on polling data. The way that the tax bill was received, the Ryan Trump tax bill was received, kind of is some indication of this. I mean, it was not popular with Americans. And then we have all this, you know, this pretty high profile polling in these past few days about these proposals. Americans seem to be kind of on a bipartisan basis okay with increasing taxes on the rich.
I think that's right. I mean, I will say there has been some variation, at least so far. It's very early in the campaigns. We'll continue to release policies. But like Kamala Harris, at least so far, has focused more on like tax breaks and credits for the middle class than tax increases on the rich. But I don't know. I think there is some risk, not to sound too Schultzian here, but I think there is some risk to Democrats in the general election, depending on how the policies are conceived of and framed. Like, I do think, going back to like the word marginal is left out a lot, a 70% tax, that sounds like a lot if you don't realize it's marginal and it's on, you know, your 10 million and one dollar. So I don't know. I think there is some risk.
While we're talking about what effect this has on the 2020 race, what is the political calculus of campaigning on taxing the wealthy from a fundraising perspective? Is it that these like small dollar Act Blue outlets make this more possible? The whole idea that they're not accepting money from super PACs anyway? Or do they really risk not being able to raise a bunch of money because of these kinds of policies?
I think if you look at some of the early proposals that the Democratic Congress is making, they are trying to increase their proposal, which won't get passed because it's a split government. Their proposal is to increase matching for small dollar donations. In other words, the Democrats' ideal in the future is to give greater power and credence to those small dollar donors, i.e., you know, the kind of electorate that got Bernie Sanders this real windfall that was unexpected. So I think that says a lot about the direction that the party sees itself taking.
Technology advances and new methods to raise money from small donors, I think, gives Democrats and everybody more flexibility to kind of piss off traditional wealthy donors. I'm not sure if anyone has like studied whether there's been like some effect in where wealthy people have less influence now, but
it's kind of funny that you would say that in like the post-Citizens United world where everyone decries all the influence of corporations and wealthy people.
Well, and Trump obviously could trigger a backlash against billionaires, right? And kind of the view or myth or whatever mystique around like the kind of self-made man, although Trump came from a family where he inherited a lot of wealth. You know, the reaction to Howard Schultz was interesting. I think by all accounts, he kind of is
self-made
and came from a very working class background. However, maybe because he's like not the most experienced politician, it comes across very much like he is just making sure that like he's that social liberal who wants to make sure that like his taxes don't go up too much. It seems a little too transparent, maybe. And the reaction to him, which by the way, in initial polling, has been very negative.
Didn't you see his campaign's internal poll, though, that put him above the 15% threshold?
We should always trust internal polls.
It's an internal poll. We're not going to actually show you the poll, tell you who it was conducted among, what questions were asked, which polling firm did it.
Howard Schultz and his immediate family think that.
All right.
He only got 17%.
He still got
though.
Only 17% of the immediate Schultz family.
Real quick, good use of polling or bad use of polling?
Horrible, horrible use of polling. Who published it?
NBC.
Yeah, I would not have published that here.
And with that horrible use of polling, according to Micah, we will wrap up the show. So, Nate, thank you so much.
I was happy to be here on the show, and thank you for having me.
That was a very glamorous laugh.
Give me your best fake laugh. That was genuine.
No, but like that's the thing. It seems genuine. That's the best fake laugh.
Yours was fake?
It's like a good bluff in poker. You don't even know that you're being bluffed.
Claire, thank you. Do you have a good fake laugh to end on?
I do.
Go for it.
I don't dance.
Do it.
Do it.
Do it.
Come on.
I don't know.
Was that a fake one? Was that
that's a real Claire laugh.
Yeah.
That's what you think.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm never my true self around.
That's what I'm saying. The bluff is you never know you're being bluffed.
So you're telling me that I've never made Claire laugh for the past 5 years? She's been fake laughing at me?
That's what bothers me about internet speak, because it's all like, I do this too, ha ha ha, or LOL. It's like, are you actually laughing out loud? No, it's so disingenuous.
You know, before Google came up with the automatic email replies, right?
Oh my God, I hate those.
I had this idea to just like actually set up a response that was sounds good for everything that someone would send, right? We just say sounds good.
An automatic reply just to every email. Is that possible to do?
Of course.
An out-of-office reply that just sounds good.
It sounds good.
My grandmother died. I'm off at the funeral this week. Sounds good.
All right. I think with that, we're going to wrap up the show.
TTYL.
TTYL, folks. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. That's it for now. Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.